The Connection on Israel, coming up. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. If it weren't for Indecision 2000 in our own country, we'd have heard a lot more by now about the political crisis in Israel. The war hero and peace Prime Minister Ehud Barak has resigned his job and called for elections in February. The plot thickens immediately with the play of technical rules that sound like third cousins of our own electoral snarl. Benjamin Netanyahu, the former prime minister and main challenger, would be ineligible to run for prime minister because he is not now a member of the Knesset. So the maneuvering begins to waive some of the rules or change some dates here. But the stakes are bigger than the maneuvering, and the connections run far and deep, with, for example, the U.S. changing of the guard, with unsticking the peace process and containing the street turmoil among Palestinians and Israelis. Connection listeners, can we see past the machinations to the fundamentals here? We're talking about Barak's gamble. The Connection phone is 1-800-423-8255. Our guest, Gershom Gorenberg, is an Israeli journalist, senior editor of the Jerusalem Report, and a student in particular of the further reaches of fundamentalism in the three faiths that key on the Holy Land and the Temple Mount in Jerusalem most especially. Gershom Gorenberg's new book is called The End of Days, Fundamentalism and the Struggle for the Temple Mount. The Temple Mount may be the most closely watched plot in all the world's real estate. It's where the new Intifada was triggered by Ariel Sharon's visit. It's where the last stage of Barak's crisis began. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. Before we get to Gershom Gorenberg and the book, first, Lee Hochstadter joins us. He's the Jerusalem correspondent of the Washington Post. Lee Hochstadter, welcome back to The Connection. What are the prospects as you feel them in Israel, with Netanyahu in the race or out? And which is it going to be?
Well, it's certainly not clear. It's a fantastically convoluted political, legal, procedural, parliamentary tangle at the moment. And nobody's quite sure how it's going to come out. Barak, as you know, was hoping to call snap elections that would exclude Netanyahu. Those elections would be at the beginning of February. But Netanyahu's allies in the Knesset, Israel's parliament, are trying to overturn that. There are a number of procedural ways to go about that. But they're in a race against time. There are only a few days in which they have to operate, and it's not clear how it's going to come out.
Make a guess, if you could strip the technicalities away. Where does Ehud Barak stand in the hearts of his countrymen these days?
I'd say he has a fairly unenviable and low position in the hearts of most of his countrymen these days. Of course, in Israel, things always break down by left and right, and in the hearts of leftist Israelis, he still has a more tender spot. But if the elections were held today, if the polls are even roughly correct, he would get creamed by Netanyahu. He's behind anywhere from 15 to 20 points, which in Israeli terms is really extraordinary because it's usually a fairly evenly divided electorate.
Can he get away with the what looks like manipulation of the game to keep Netanyahu out? I mean, or does that make him automatically kind of too clever by half?
Well, it's not really manipulation. This is the law. Not only is this the law, but it's a law for which Netanyahu, when Netanyahu was a member of the Knesset in 1992, not only Netanyahu voted for this law, and not only did he advocate this law publicly, but he cast the key deciding tie-breaking vote in favor of this law in defiance of his own party. So Barak's not really doing anything that's very sneaky. He's simply taking advantage of what everybody knew was the law. And the law in Israel is that a prime minister can resign at any point in his election in order to seek a fresh mandate. And when he does, it triggers what's known as a special election. In other words, not a general election for parliament and the prime minister, but simply an election for the prime minister in which the Knesset, the parliament, stays in place. So this is the law of which Barak availed himself, perfectly legal. However, it's not too complicated to figure out why he did this. He's so far behind in the polls to Netanyahu, and by availing himself of this law, the effect is to cut Netanyahu out of the game. So he does look, he looks a little sneaky by doing it, but on the other hand, it's a perfectly legal procedure.
Make the connection, Lee Hochstadter, if you can, with the the new intifada and also the transition in the United States? I mean, this is a five-dimensional chess game here, but what does it have to do with rescuing the peace press process, drawing Arafat back into the dialogue? I mean, what are the war and peace dimensions and the international politics dimensions?
Well, as you may know, Barak's popularity has plummeted since the Palestinian uprising broke out at the end of September. It's widely thought that his only chance at re-election, whether the elections are in February or March or April or May or whenever they come, that his best chance is to secure some sort of a deal, a peace deal, with the Palestinians. However, that looks very tough right now. The conventional wisdom is that if he has any chance at all of securing a deal, it's going to be it would have to happen before President Clinton leaves office. Clinton, as you know, has been intimately, personally involved in mediating Middle East peace efforts, both at the Y Plantation in Maryland, at Camp David last summer, in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, a couple of months ago. He's been in up to his elbows. And so it's widely thought that once Clinton leaves the White House January 20th, that the chances then for a peace deal immediately drop off. They're probably already remote, but they really drop off after January 20th because there would be no more immediate influential U.S. mediator in the person of President Clinton. So I think Barak was looking at this and thinking, well, I probably don't have much of a chance for a peace deal anytime soon anyway, but if I have any chance at all, that chance probably ends January 20th, so I might as well have elections sooner rather than later. And by availing himself of this special law, he accelerates the election timetable. It would trigger elections in about 60 days, more or less around February 6th. So that's the tie-in. In other words, why wait for months and months when, after January 20th, in Barak's view, he probably has very little chance of a peace deal anyway?
Lee Hochstetter, that's important fundamental background on the politics of the politics. I want to introduce Gershom Gorenberg, who's especially, in a certain way, is the theology behind all this politics. Gershom Gorenberg, explain how the Temple Mount is geographically, tactically, sentimentally, but also in a deeper way, theologically, at the core of this thing.
Well, the Temple Mount, which is the which takes up 1/6 of Jerusalem's walled Old City, is the original location of the ancient Jewish temples and today's location of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. But much more than that, it is mythological ground zero in Judaism, Islam, and for certain streams of Christianity. It is, for instance, the place where traditionally in Judaism, Abraham nearly sacrificed Isaac, which is a founding moment in Judaism. It's the place in Islam, it's called the furthest mosque, and that's not just a matter of physical location, that's a matter of spiritual location. It's the place where the ultimate person in Islam, the Prophet Muhammad, had the ultimate experience of ascending to heaven. So in both religions, this becomes, as it were, the gateway to heaven. It's also the gateway to the end of days. The construction of the third temple has always been associated in Judaism with the coming of the Messiah, with the end of history as we know it, and the creation of a perfected kingdom on earth. In many Islamic traditions, the Haram al-Sharif, the Temple Mount, is the location of final judgment. There's even traditions that say that the Kaaba in Mecca, the central Islamic shrine, will literally move to Jerusalem at the time of the end. So the spot, this place located inside the city, you can get there by bus, take a quick turn around the money changer, don't step on the garbage, and you arrive at the place where the world began and ended. That's a huge mythological load to place on one spot. What's more is that it's taken on nearly equal significance in the national movements who inherited those symbols from religion. In Zionism, the Temple Mount became a symbol of Jewish return to the land, such that in 1967, when an Israeli colonel announced in a battlefield statement over his radio to his commander, "The Temple Mount is in our hand," on the face of it, a military statement like saying Hill 63 is in our hand, it was in fact a statement of the Jews have completed their return to their homeland. They've reached the center. It became the very symbol of the victory and of the completion of what Zionism was supposed to do. So for Israelis, even many left-wingers who don't know quite why, and secularists who don't think of themselves as accepting the theology, the idea of giving up the Temple Mount seems very difficult to stomach. On the other hand, Al-Aqsa, the name of the mosque and the name that is applied to the Mount as a whole often by Palestinians, represents for Palestinian nationalists the conquest, the fact that the Jews hold this spot, and the hope of independence. If Jewish nationalism is called Zionism, today you could practically refer to Palestinian nationalism as Al-Aqsa-ism. Without getting Al-Aqsa, there's no real Palestinian independence. That creates a zero-sum game around this single spot. And that's where negotiations slammed into a brick wall at Camp David. Nobody managed to get them started again in a serious way in the next 2 months. And when Ariel Sharon visited the spot in September, Palestinians interpreted that as an Israeli statement that no compromise was possible. I think they misinterpreted it as, in many cases, as Sharon doing Barak's work by doing that. Now, in terms of Israeli domestic politics, that seems
Why was it Barak's work?
Well, because Palestinians had received the impression from the negotiations that the Israelis were unwilling to give up sovereignty over the Temple Mount, over Al-Aqsa. And many Palestinians believed that when Sharon went there, it was an Israeli statement of control of the spot. I think that this is the typical situation where from the outside, differences and nuances disappear and everything looks like people are working together. I think the same thing happens on the Israeli side, where very often everything that any Palestinian does is immediately attributed to the machinations of Yasser Arafat rather than to the complexities of Palestinian politics. But the impression of the visit was to say the Israelis intend to hold what the Palestinians saw as the essential symbol of their independence, of the end of the occupation. And so that's where everything exploded.
Well, certainly Sharon knew the sensitivities that he was tweaking there and the delicacy of the moment. In what sense would you say that the Barak's political crisis was kind of crystallized at that moment and in that place?
Well, there's a couple of things there. First of all, Sharon visited the Mount a few days after the Israeli Attorney General decided not to press charges against Netanyahu on various corruption points, various corruption allegations. So exactly at the moment that Sharon realized that he did have a rival for the leadership of the right, he decided to exploit a symbolic spot in order to establish his credentials as the master of the nationalism of myth and soil and romance. Barak was put in a bind. If he told Sharon that he couldn't go there for security reasons, it would look to the Israeli public like he had already conceded the spot to the Palestinians. And he was already weakened by concessions he had offered at Camp David in July. And after that, he had already lost his coalition. He apparently felt that he simply couldn't pay that price in the Israeli public. On the other hand, it seems to me that he tragically underestimated the impact that the visit would have on the Palestinians. When the new Intifada began and left the peace process of the last 7 years in shambles, Barak's own promise to make peace, his own political principle, the reason that he had been elected, also evaporated. He was a peacemaker who hadn't made peace. His claim that Israel needed a man like him instead of Netanyahu to bring peace with the Palestinians was fatally injured. So by letting Sharon go there for domestic reasons, he in fact paid an extremely high domestic price.
Does the call an election maneuver and call an election in February when Netanyahu's entry will be disputed, does this get Barak out of that bind? As you said, of the peacemaker who hadn't made peace?
I think that Mr. Barak is playing double or nothing here. He knows that Netanyahu at the moment looks like a very formidable opponent. He knows that Sharon has a longer and more controversial record. This is the same Ariel Sharon that an Israeli commission of inquiry found indirectly responsible for the Sabra and Shatila massacre in Beirut in 1982, the man who was the architect of the invasion of Lebanon that ended so tragically for both Lebanon and Israel. And there's a deep hatred for Sharon in large parts of the Israeli population. So Barak is figuring that if people aren't going to vote for him, they'll vote against Sharon. Of course, the risk involved there for the country is that if Barak loses, in fact, Sharon becomes prime minister. The same Sharon who was disqualified from ever serving as defense minister by that Israeli commission of inquiry,
Sharon
would now
thing,
become prime minister.
What about Netanyahu? If he can get into this race, I mean, you heard Lee Hochstetter say that he beats Barak handily in the polls today.
Well, first of all, virtual candidates who have not yet started running, always do far better in the polls. The questions have not yet begun to be asked of them. The nitty-gritty of the campaign has not yet begun. I'm certain that if he enters the campaign, if he's allowed to run and the campaign gets going, that gap is likely to shrink. But in general, human beings behave in such a way that pain experienced is worse than pain remembered. So a lot of Israelis may remember the discomfort of Netanyahu's career as prime minister, but that's already nearly 2 years ago. It's an eon ago, whereas the failed diplomatic moves and the coalition collapse of Barak is right now, and that gives Netanyahu a major advantage in the race. I think that in many, many cases, people tend to vote against more than they vote for. Hmm. This will be a referendum on Barak, and he's not in a very good position for a referendum.
Interesting. 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about Israeli politics and their version of the Chad debate. Will Bibi Netanyahu be a candidate for prime minister in February, if that's when the elections are held? It's a referendum, says our guest Gershom Gorenberg, on the peace efforts, the fruitless peace efforts so far, of Prime Minister Ehud Barak. 1-800-423-TALK makes the Israeli politics connection. Rabbi Ben Yehuda is on the line from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Thank you. I am calling about the statement with which you began the program, and I wanted to talk about that for a minute. You said that the recent intifada was triggered by Sharon, and I think that the facts actually argue against that, because the first couple of incidents that took place in the current intifada took place before Sharon went to Temple Mount. There was a killing of an officer who was on patrol with a mixed Palestinian-Israeli.
Are you saying that the intifada was continuous, or that the visit to the Temple Mount didn't matter that
much? I'm saying that the Sharon visit was just an excuse, and it was really not what triggered the events.
It was whose excuse? His or?
It was an excuse by the Arabs to call it the Al-Aqsa Intifada. Actually, it began a couple of days before that, when an Israeli officer was killed by a Palestinian officer while they were on combined patrol.
What if Ariel Sharon thought he was handing them an excuse? In other words, provoking them?
The thing is that they didn't need an excuse. They were planning to have this demonstration of their power and of their ability to disrupt. Yasser Arafat is not really in control. Everybody likes to suggest that he is in control all the time. But he came back from Camp David having not accepted the terms that Barak offered. And he was handed continued defeats when he went to Europe to try and gain some kind of leverage against Barak, in the next stage of negotiations, possibly at the UN.
There's so much history here. Just give us your take on the Barak election.
Okay. Now, talking about the Barak election, first of all, we have to understand that in Israel they have a double election. One is the election of the prime minister, and the other one is the election of the Knesset. Now, the election of the prime minister at this moment can be held within the next 60 days, irrelevant of what happens to the Knesset. But if that were to happen, Barak is going, even if assuming that he's going to win this kind of an election, he's going to end up exactly where he is right now, which is without a coalition and without a mandate to rule. Everybody will say, oh, yes, you know, Barak has a mandate. He is the one who was voted prime minister, but he cannot achieve a coalition, therefore he cannot rule.
Gershom Gorenberg, what's your take? I mean, that he can't solve his crisis by getting reelected himself.
He, in fact, since the time he was elected, the day that he won the election to prime minister, he lost the Knesset. There is a right-wing majority in the Knesset, and he will continue to contend with that even if he is reelected. However, it's certainly true that if the electorate does choose him again, he will be able to turn to the parties in the Knesset and say, I have just received a public mandate to continue making efforts toward peace. And the likelihood will be that he will have an easier time recreating a coalition to pursue a peace policy. Mm. That's in terms of the peace situation. The second thing is I want to relate to the comments that were made about the beginning of the Intifada. I don't think that they hold up. The incident that was referred to, the shooting of the Israeli officer, in fact, took place after Sharon's visit to the Mount, if you go back and check the exact times and dates. The mass violence, the riots in the streets, the people coming out into the streets took place after Sharon's visit and then after the incidents at the Temple Mount at Al-Haram al-Sharif the following day. There have always been, despite the efforts at peace, clashes, breakdowns at the edges. What we're seeing here over the last 2 months is something very different from that. What we're seeing here is an explosion of an entire population, and that was set off by a symbolic action, by something that raised the emotional level sharply above what it had been before. Palestinians before that moment were extremely frustrated with where the peace process was going and also extremely hopeful. They hoped to see independence. They were frustrated that it wasn't happening. As is often the case, you could talk to many people and hear them express contradictory emotions virtually within a moment of conversation. What the Sharon visit did is it supercharged the frustration, overcame people's inhibitions, brought out the anger, and brought people into the streets. The Al-Aqsa Intifada, uncomfortable as it may be for us to recognize, was in fact over Al-Aqsa. However, one thing that needs to be added to that is that to a large extent, I would say the Palestinians, and particularly Arafat himself, can be said to have issued the invitation to Sharon to come to the Mount, because in the months between Camp David and Sharon's visit, Palestinian spokesmen consistently denied that there was any Jewish connection to this site. For many Israelis, and again, not just Israelis who are right of center, but Israelis who are left of center, this was an extremely disturbing statement, because if the Jews don't have a connection to the Temple Mount, which is the center of Jewish history in the land, what it's essentially saying is that there's no Jewish history in the place. It's a shorthand for the Palestinian claim that Israelis are not returning to their homeland, but they're just European colonists. And
precisely who is it among the Palestinians who says that?
This has been the party line for a long time. I mean, the whole time that I was working on the writing of my book, for instance, which was before Camp David, obviously, virtually every Palestinian that I spoke to recited the mantra that there's no archaeological evidence that the temple ever stood at this spot and so forth. Archaeologically, that's nonsense. But the point is that has been a long-time position. What happened is in the final status negotiations, where the future of the Temple Mount became a central issue, this kind of statement became something that was being said publicly. And therefore, it was the most natural thing possible for a right-wing politician like Sharon to say, I will become a hero by demonstrating this
connection. Gershom Gorenberg, stand by. I want to. I have to let Lee Hochstetter go at the break. And I just want to get your view as a as an American reporter in Jerusalem, Lee, do you call it the Al-Aqsa Intifada and take its temperature today?
Well, it doesn't really matter what I call it. The fact is, as Gershom points out, that the Palestinians call it the Al-Aqsa Intifada. I would also reinforce and agree with Gershom's point about Sharon. The truth is that this debate over whether Sharon's visit was a pretext or an excuse or a trigger, it's a semantic debate, and the differences are non-existent. People in relationships, just as Palestinians and Israelis in their own relationship, can skate on a very thin ice for a very long time. The truth is that it takes something to break that ice. It takes a trigger for the process to break down. And that's what Sharon provided. Whether it was pretext, whether it was cause, whether it was trigger, is really not relevant. He was the catalyst for this uprising that we're seeing now.
We tend to lose track of the death counts in the new Intifada. As I say, take its temperature as of this week.
I would say that this uprising, this Palestinian revolt, has steadily intensified. But if you looked at a graph, it would have a lot of spikes and valleys.
I see.
Overall, though, it's intensified, and you see a lot more shooting and violent incidents that go beyond stone throwing, go beyond the kind of dynamic that we saw in the first Intifada of a decade ago.
Lee Hochstetter of The Washington Post, I have to let you go with thanks again from The Connection. We're talking about the politics in Israel. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking about Barak's gamble, his resignation from the Prime Minister's office in Israel, and his call for elections in February. Bibi Netanyahu, the former Prime Minister, may or may not qualify to run. Our guest is Gershom Gorenberg, whose new book is called The End of Days. The phone is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the political crisis in Israel. Hassan Katib is on the line. He's a Palestinian who runs the Jerusalem Media and Communications Center. Hassan Katib, what does all this mean to Palestinians? What's the risk of a Netanyahu government? What is the chance of a Sharon government? What is the promise of a Barak government?
Well, unfortunately, recently the Palestinians have been finding difficulties in differentiating between the Labour and the Likud, between Netanyahu Sharon on one hand and Barak on the other hand. Since we had this experience with this last Israeli Labour government, Barak's government, and there are three criteria of judging the Israeli parties from a Palestinian perspective, from a Palestinian point of view. The first one is the Israeli illegal settlement expansion policy, and in this regard, we did not see any difference.
Settlements, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean Israel has been illegally and against the international law and the several Security Council resolutions have been confiscating Palestinian land in the Palestinian occupied territories and building Jewish settlements there illegally and on land belonged to Palestinians whom are still alive and carrying the deeds of ownership of their land in their pockets. Now, this policy has continued and actually escalated by this Israeli Labour government. Second, the two parties, the governments led by the two parties, were equally not really committed to implementing the signed agreements. And Barak's government imposed a certain agreement, and then Barak simply decided that he wanted to interrupt the implementation of this interim agreement and pushed everybody to go prematurely to the final status negotiations, the failure of which, in my view, was responsible for the outbreak of violence and confrontations. And thirdly, And finally, the positions over final status issues of the two parties are equally far from the international legality and from the relevant Security Council resolution, because we, when we were invited for this peace process by the American government, it was about the principle of exchanging land for peace on the basis of the Security Council Resolution 242, which has very specific and clear borders. It's the borders of 1967. The two Israeli parties are not willing to abide by a settlement that would satisfy the international law and the relevant Security Council resolution. That's why, to the first time in this election, you do not see the Palestinians able to make really difference between the two.
That's fascinating. But you mean to say it doesn't matter?
I want to say that it doesn't matter significantly.
That's very interesting. Gershom Gorenberg, does that surprise you? Gershom Gorenberg, sorry.
This is a common refrain from Palestinians, including Palestinians who are sensitive to Israeli politics and who are interested in continuing the process, but I do think that it's a misevaluation of the situation. As I said before, when Barak was elected prime minister, he was elected with what was essentially from the beginning an opposition Knesset, and he formed a coalition in order to rule that included right-wing parties, and that's a large part of why the settlement effort continued. I definitely think that the continuation of that settlement effort made it much more difficult for him to negotiate and to appear to be negotiating in good faith. However, there's a clear distinction between the long-range intent of Barak's government on the one hand and of Netanyahu or Sharon on the other. In the in practical terms, the side of Israeli politics that Barak represents is one that sees it as being in Israel's practical advantage to reach an agreement with the Palestinians to end the occupation. There are clearly deep disagreements with the Palestinians on precisely where the lines need to be drawn and how that will be done. But the goal is to end the occupation. On the side of Sharon and Netanyahu, the entire peace process is regarded as something that was imposed upon them by previous labor governments, by American pressure, the essential belief that Israel should be ruling the entire territory regardless of the Palestinian population remains at the core of their ideology. And I think that that should be significant both for Jews and for Palestinians. On a deeper level, on the level of symbol and basic emotion, Sharon and Netanyahu are people who believe in the sanctity of soil, in the who have a mythic conception of history and of politics, in which virtually there are two nations facing each other, and very little of the individual differences in either one of them, and Barak represents a pragmatic tradition in Israeli politics. The tragedy of the situation is that Barak has done a poor job in representing that. As a leader, he hasn't been very effective.
I don't want to overdo these parallels with the United States, but you sound an awful lot like Democrats, Gore Democrats in this American campaign trying to remind Nader voters of the real distinctions, the bigger differences between George Bush and Al Gore. I mean, maybe that's too obvious even to comment on, but...
Well, within the Israeli body politic, I don't think this reminder would need to be made. Israeli politics is much more intense than American politics have been at any time since perhaps the Vietnam War. The kind of intensity that you saw 30 years ago in America is the baseline in Israel, and then sometimes it works its way up from there. But in terms of the outside observer, even the outside observer who's only a 5-minute drive away in East Jerusalem or in Ramallah or in Hebron, sometimes these distinctions may get lost. What I do think is the really sad parallel to American politics, and I say this as somebody who is both an Israeli and who grew up in America, is that in each case we're looking at elections which have offered choices that voters are not particularly excited about. I mean, I think it's clear that when you look at the American situation and the virtual tie vote, that part of what's going on there is that people is that neither candidate managed to create a sense of sweeping the public along with him. Mm-hmm. In the Israeli case, you're talking about two people. If Netanyahu runs, you're talking about two people who have been prime minister and have each done poorly at the job, trying to convince the electorate that the other guy is even worse. That doesn't make for a very optimistic election campaign.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Barack's Gamble connection, or 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Gershom Gorenberg and also with Hassan Khatib, who runs the Jerusalem Media and Communications Center, with a Palestinian perspective. 1-800-423-TALK. Marty is calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hi.
Hello, Marty.
Listen, I'm very pessimistic. I have always been very pro-peace. I think the settlements are a disaster, like Balkanization of Israel. I knew that it was going to be a problem when they started this, and I think they should all go home and pay them off, and I was against any monies going there. But me now, I'm a barometer of this. I think it was Abba Iban who said the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And here, they have now created in me and my friends in Israel the fear that we are back to 1948. I don't care what they say about the Temple Mount and Sharon. They could have protested that any number of peaceful ways, and they could have done it legally. They instead threw rocks, Molotov cocktails, shot guns, put children in the way, and then they have Saeb Erekat and Hanan Ashrawi making me so furious, attempting to say that this is peaceful demonstrations and the Israeli army is committing aggression, and calling for the United Nations to come in and save them, when it is them that are doing the rock throwing, the gasoline bomb throwing, and putting children where they can be shot.
Marty, is there anybody you haven't offended here, or that you're not thoroughly disgusted with?
You know who I haven't offended? The people of Israel who wanted peace before this happened. Now, instead of being feeling that they can be secure and turning over their lives and their security with people right across the border from them, where they were willing to follow into a peace agreement and give Palestinians even their own state. It wouldn't be the entire state of Israel, because that's impossible, but they were willing to be give them the part of the Palestine that they're in. Now they fear their lives. There will never be a peace agreement with people who you deal with when they believe they're throwing rocks, Molotov cocktails, machine guns, and then crying for the world to come save them for what they are doing.
Gershom Gore, I mean, Marty, are you presenting yourself as a, as you said, an American barometer?
I'm an American who has very strong pro-Israeli views, but also very pro-Jordanian, and I have friends there. I visited there. I like Arabs and as a people. I believe that they can live in peace, but I think the Arabs have poisoned the well. They have now created a situation where Israelis, who thought they were dealing with someone that they could make peace with, now find they have no one to make peace with.
Marty, thank you. Let's make that a kind of interested American baseline. Gershom Gorenberg, can we deal with it?
Well, I think that in an American accent, he's done a good job of expressing the views of a large portion of the swing vote in Israel, and explained to us exactly why Barack is going to have such a hard time being reelected. It's that many people who were supporters of the peace process now are deeply questioning whether or not they have a partner. And I must say that, for instance, when you have the experiences I have had of hearing the gunfire at night from the next neighborhood, of Palestinians firing into a residential neighborhood in Jerusalem, one has to ask questions about how easy it is going to be to find an agreement now. In particular, we're dealing, when we're looking for an agreement with the Palestinians, with dividing up an incredibly small piece of space. And the need for borders to run between Jewish and Arab communities that are inches apart. And it has become considerably more difficult as a result of the violence of recent weeks for any Israeli government to make an agreement that creates the risk of more Palestinian guns being that close to Jewish homes. And so the process of peacemaking, whatever the frustrations were and the dissatisfaction with the Israeli offers and the emotional reaction to the Sharon visit was, there's no doubt that the business of peacemaking will be more difficult now. I think that
I want to ask Hassan Katib. I mean, I think Marty, as you say, in an American accent, voices this kind of radical impatience, a certain recoiling from both sides, but acutely from the Palestinian case at this moment. Hassan Katib, what do you hear in that?
Well, I think that there is a big misunderstanding, and I think that the international media is not necessarily transmitting the reality as it is. And history, as it seems, starts in different points for different persons. Mm-hmm. History did not start with this intifada, actually. This intifada is a result of a continuous Israeli occupation that is in violation of all human rights. The Palestinian people are the only people on earth whom are still living under military belligerent occupation. And the Palestinians have been trying to use whatever possible mean in order to end this occupation, and this is only legitimate. Now, the current violence is not the cause of the tragedy. It is the result of the tragedy. It is the Palestinians' way to tell the world that peace process and settlement expansion process are incompatible, and that when Israel negotiate the future of the Palestinian territories, including the future of the illegal Jewish settlements, and continue to expand these settlements, this is not negotiations in good faith. This is only taking advantage of the imbalance of powers and trying to eat the cake and keep it in the same time, and this is something we're not willing to live with, because this is being on the account of our legitimate national rights, religious rights, whatever kind of rights.
I mean, life is a matter of perspective, and they're very, very different on this issue. 1-800-423-8255 joins the Barak's Gamble connection on what could be the eve of a new election campaign in Israel. Yale is on the line.
Hi. I would first like to just elaborate on the anecdote that was cited by your speaker earlier about the capture of the Temple Mount in 1967, because there's sort of a conclusion to it which wasn't mentioned, and that is after this colonel announced that they had captured the Temple Mount, he raised the Israeli flag over the Temple Mount, and Moshe Dayan ordered him to take it down. He said they had won the military battle. They did not want to start a religious war. Hmm. Now, I think it's ironic that there was that level of sensitivity at that time, which is long since gone. I'd also like to say that I don't count myself part of the baseline described by Marty. I think your Palestinian speaker puts things in a way that at least a small number of American Jews recognize to be the case. Israel has been practicing ethnic cleansing for 50 years, and the American media have told very little of this tale.
Yeah, I don't want to re-argue the whole history of absolutely everything, but I'd be fascinated, Gershom Gorenberg, on your take on the famous Moshe Dayan story, and how feeling has changed.
I think it was cited by Benny Morris.
I'd like to comment on
his book, Righteous Victims. I think that's where the quote comes.
Yeah, no, I heard the story from you, and we've heard it, of course, before. Gershom, give us your take on it, and the change in sensitivity and perspective.
Well, there's Dayan's action at the time of the Six-Day War in insisting that Al-Haram al-Sharif, that the Temple Mount remained under Muslim administration, was, in my mind, one of the real victory of the war, because what Dayan did at that point and what Israel did when it insisted that the place for Jewish prayer would remain the Western Wall next to the Mount rather than on the Mount itself is defied the history of Jerusalem, in which each new conqueror had always thrown out the previous religion and installed its own, particularly at the Temple Mount. And it was, I think, a great moment. At the same time, it was always a de facto arrangement. Israel was never able to come out de jure and say that there was a separation, a division of holy space at the core of Jerusalem. The official policy, the legal policy, is that Al-Aqsa is under Israeli sovereignty. The de facto policy is that Jews pray at one spot and Muslims pray at another. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly the uncertainty that the final status agreement was supposed to finally end and create, establish a regime, a legal situation of division and of agreement in Jerusalem. If that were achieved, it would bring about a peace not only between two national groups, but between two religions, and it's of utmost importance. However, I think that we have to recognize that the religious element has been present in the conflict from the very beginning, all the way back to 1929. Violence between Jews and Arabs began at the Temple Mount over religious issues. So when we're trying to solve that problem today, we're trying to solve a very old problem. I'd like to comment on one more point that was brought up by two of the people who spoke just now, and that is the issue of the media. I find it sadly amusing that on both sides there are these accusations against the media. There's many right-wing Israelis who keep insisting that the Israeli story isn't being told, the right details aren't being told as the media reports on what's going on. We hear a Palestinian spokesman saying that the right story isn't being told. I don't think it's the media's job to tell the story for either side, but to tell the story of what is going on right now. There's obviously much greater background. You're not going to get the whole story in your daily paper or in our conversation now, but that doesn't mean that that we should be talking about shooting the messenger. The messenger is trying to portray what's going on at this moment. And the real problem is not the media. It's the conflict itself that has to be solved. Gershom, the criticism of the media, I think, is a red herring.
I want to get one more caller in. Kevin is on the line.
Hi there.
Hey, Welcome, Kevin.
I wanted to ask, over the last 20 years, there's been several prime ministers of Israel, from Barak, Bibi, Sharon. Would the peace process have any better chance if there was a change in the Palestinian leadership? I'll listen off the line.
Interesting question. The leadership on the Palestinian side never changes.
I don't think that you're going to see that change in the coming weeks ahead either. The fact is that with all the problems that Israelis can see and can legitimately raise with Arafat's leadership, and that goes not only to his conduct in the peace process, but the criticism that many Palestinians have raised against his regime for corruption and for lack of democracy, he is the person with the widest possible support. And as diplomats have pointed out to me, in a peace process, in an agreement, you not only need to reach the agreement, you need to sell the agreement to the public. There's nobody more capable on the Palestinian side of selling an agreement if it is reached than Yasser Arafat.
I wanted to ask Hassan Khati before we're gone, is there an alternative?
The Palestinian people have the intention and the desire to practice democracy and to elect the leadership, except that they have been under occupation and elections were prevented by Israel, and the Palestinian leadership were not allowed to live among the Palestinian people until recently, after the Oslo agreement, in which the Palestinians took the first opportunity of democratic elections and conducted democracy. And since then, this peace process is not allowing any further repetition of that possibility. So we have to blame the Israeli occupation for not allowing the Palestinians to live as normal society who might be able to enjoy democracy.
Hassan Khatib, thank you. Hassan Khatib at the Jerusalem Media and Communications Center. Gershom Gorenberg, thank you for joining us, and thank you for the book, The End of Days, about fundamentalism and the struggle for the Temple Mount. Thank you, Lee Hochstadter, too, of the Washington Post. Connection listeners, you can continue the Israeli political conversation on our website at theconnection.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.